Hello, my name is Thomas Dinas, and this is the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Welcome to another archaeogastronomical adventure. And this time, I'm going to make you travel with me down to the Eastern Aegean Sea and the Eastern Mediterranean in general, where we will explore some strange Mediterranean flavors. Some spices from the ancient Mediterranean world, but also extremely popular nowadays and widespread, I would say, to our modern cooking, which is rather interesting. And it's very, very fascinating to find out the origins of these ingredients. While by no means unknown, I think they deserve a lot more recognition and a lot more use in our cuisine. One of them is quite difficult to find here, but if you go to good Greek delicatessens, I'm sure they will sell it. The others are far more widespread, but I urge you to find them in good spice shops or some Middle Eastern supermarkets. They will have far better and fresher quality. And that's with all herbs and spices. The fresher it is, obviously the better it is, and use it as soon as you open it. My advice with spices and herbs is always don't buy huge quantities, rather buy small quantities that you can use them and they won't lose their potency. Okay, so off we go to our first little mysterious ingredient. Mastic. Masticha in Greek. Mastic is one of the names given to the droplets, to the resinous droplets of a gum that flows from the wounds of the cultivated Pistacia lentiscus variation chia, a tree which is a close relative of the tree that yields the pistachio nuts. Now, Masticha is very, very prominent and very famous in Greece, obviously, but it's very... The island of Chios is very famous for Masticha. In fact, it's considered the only place that has a proper Masticha. So we have a very specific and distinctive terroir here. The sweetest resinous gum and the most fragrant one comes from the Greek island of Chios, or Chios in the Aegean Sea. There, the clear nectar-like resin that weeps from the wounds inflicted on the leafy shrub-like tree is called the Tears of Chios and is carefully harvested and dried into a hard and translucent mass that looks like peanut brittle. This Masticha is cultivated since the ancient times. Ancient Greeks, at least from the time Herodotus, so around the 4th, maybe 5th century BCE, we have mentions of Masticha from the island of Chios. The ancient Greeks using it as a chewing gum. Etymologically, if you think about it, the word masticated, which means chewing in a sense, comes from the Greek word masticha. So the English term mastic is borrowed from the Greek word masticha. And they're both, obviously the Greek is coming, I guess, from the Phoenician word mastichan, to chew. So yeah, it was used as an ancient form of chewing gum to clean the teeth, as a breath freshener, and also had various other uses throughout the millennia that's been cultivated, such as a perfume, a varnish, a medicine, and it's been made into a digestive for at least 2,400 years. Over time, Mediterranean cultures identified additional culinary and enological uses, so it's been used in wines and other alcoholic beverages for this versatile gum. So today, most of the Chios production is used in liquors and pastries and candies. Now, although the tree can be found throughout the Mediterranean basin and in many different islands, now this beautiful resinous gum only comes from the island of Chios. In fact, there are also some Lebanese that they also do have some trees. So the Lebanese cultivate the same species, but they use it for its nut-like fruits to flavor sausages. And they use the mastic as well, apparently. But legally they cannot sell it as mastic, and the taste is different. The terroir is not the same. And there is also a Bombay mastic harvested from another tree of the genus Pistachia. So mastic is an essential ingredient in many anise-flavored distilled beverages, including the Greek ouzo and the Turkish and Cretan raki. In addition to using masticha in their own ouzo, the residents of Chios also make a sweet-smelling liquor called mastichato. The Greeks also use masticha in two refreshing summertime drinks, one called soumada, a mix of mastic, cane sugar, almond milk, and the potted liquor tsipouro, and another summertime drink, which we used to have a lot as kids in my family, and throughout Greece, I think, up until recently, I guess. I don't know if people still do that. It's called hippovrychio, which means submarine, which consists of mastic, honey, and cold water. Basically, mainly mastic. Honey is very rare, but mainly a teaspoon or a tablespoon full of mastic mass, and dipped in cold water, in iced water. And basically, you eat that as a sweet, refreshing drink. Obviously, the best thing is the liquor masticha, masticha liquor that is made with the flavoring. But if you're not drinking, if you're not, if you're a teetotaler, then you can sample masticha in some of the famous confections called lukumia, or Turkish lukum, the Turkish delight, which is found throughout the Middle East. Mastic is also used to flavor and thicken puddings, candies, sweet pastries, ice creams, jams, and even cheeses. And it can be rubbed for baked or fried poultry and seafood to give them a distinctive crust. Even though those uses sound quite secular, there's also in the Greek Orthodox faith, there are many feasts and fasting days that celebrate and they use masticha as a frankincense. But in terms of food, food wise as well, it's been used in festival breads such as Vasilopita. And it's also the key ingredient of a very interesting lamb and a chickpea stew from Hu Zuhui, I think a Chinese or Mongolian writer who recommended that to his Mongolian emperor. And it's been recorded as a soup for the Khan, one of the classic food history of the Silk Roads. The tree, the masticha tree in Greek, called skinos, and generally can be found in just 24 villages in the southern part of the island of Chios. They are called mastichochoria, and they also are recognized by the EU as a PDO, so the product is protected designation of origin. And it's so specific. I mean, just the southern part of the island in only 24 villages. They've tried to cultivate it in the north part of the island, but they didn't succeed. They transplanted some trees from the south of the island to the north and didn't happen. It seems like the southern hilly part, which has a distinctive climate that is mild in the winter and dry in the summer, it gives them the masticha raisin the qualities to dry and harden properly and acquire the taste that it has. And the rain is important to not come early in the summer or early in the autumn, because it means we'll wash the harvest away. Of course, from the ancient times, masticha was a valuable commodity, as valuable as diamonds, apparently. And it's been cultivated and used and provided a big salary for the Byzantine emperors back in the medieval times and Middle Ages, as it was a very exclusive product only grown in this part of the world. Also, subsequent conquerors like the Genoese and the Turkish and the Ottomans, they obviously took care to protect the trade of this product and the cultivation and the growing of the trees. And this is my little story for masticha. Do try and find it. I'll post some links on my Patreon page and on Acast, so you can follow and find how it looks, where you can find it, and so on. And exclusively for my Patreon backers only, I will have some recipes with masticha and with the other spices we're going to check out now.
Today's episode comes with the welcome support of Malby & Greek, the number one delicatessen, supplier and distributor of premium Greek produce from all the wild corners of Greece and with products from small artisanal producers. So why not try today some of the Malby & Greek's amazing early harvest extra virgin olive oil, their own one, which I find fantastically delicious, and some six-month barrel-aged feta cheese from Costarellos, and some of the double-baked barley rusts from Kythira, and of course, the wild Cretan oregano. Very few ingredients, very simple ingredients, but together the combination is exquisite. So what I do is take a barley rusk, put a bit of feta cheese, drizzle with a bit of olive oil, and I sprinkle it with a bit of oregano, and this is simple yet super delicious starter for anyone. Anyone will eat it and enjoy it. This is something I swear by. Try it and you won't regret it. Malby & Greek, the one-stop shop for your Greek fix. You can buy the exquisite goods online at malbyandgreek.com or if you go to the shop in Bermondsey, Lucy Way. And of course, for you, dear listeners, there is a 15% discount if you buy online with the code DELICIOUS. Enjoy!
Sesame. Sesame, obviously, is not a very forgotten plant, and it's not really... Yeah, it's vastly used by many, many different civilizations and cuisines, and we associate a lot with the Chinese, I suppose, with Chinese culture and cuisine nowadays. But sesame seeds and sesame has been used for thousands of years. The oldest sesame seeds found in archaeological context come from the Indus Valley, the site called Harappa, which is now in Pakistan, and they date back 4,000 to 4,600 years. And this discovery appears to indicate that the sesame was first domesticated more than 4.5 millennia ago, somewhere there in the Indian subcontinent, I suppose, and probably spread from there towards the Mesopotamia within 500 years. Most of the wild relatives of sesame are found in Africa, but only one particular wild ancestor, the S. orientale variation Malabaricum, is restricted to the Indian subcontinent. And hence from here we have this traveling route of the seed. Sesame seeds were pressed into the only oil used by the Babylonians and reached the Egyptians by 1500 BCE. By 200 BCE, the sesame started to grow in China, and it's been there long enough to become a prevalent crop. There are many Chinese varieties which spread westwards into Central Asia along the Silk Roads. And black sesame seeds caught many forms of sushi in Japan and, of course, anywhere else that makes sushi. The raw or toasted seeds of the Sesamum indicum offer a pleasantly sharp, somewhat nutty flavor that favors their use as both a spice and a cooking oil. In fact, the seeds are 60% oil by weight, and the sesame plant may be the source of the world's first cultivated oilseed, as I said, having been domesticated in the Indian subcontinent well before any written records in Eurasian and African civilizations. The sesame plant is an annual herb with lovely tubular flowers, and it produces a small teardrop-shaped seed that comes in all shades of white, pale red, brown, beige and jet black. Sesame seeds came out of the Malabar coast to reach Mesopotamia during the early Bronze Age, and they were known as Taila or Tila, which is a generic term in ancient Sanskrit that was used in northern India to refer to the oiliness of any seed. Along the same line, the Akkadian term Samasamu means oily or fatty seed. The later related Assyrian term, Shaman Shami, may have given rise to the Aramaic Shumshema, also written as Shumshem, the ancient Arabic as Sam, and the modern Arabic as Simsim. The Hebrew term Shumshum is similar, all connote oily seeds. And you can see from all of them the root of the word sesame, right? Today's modern Persian konjed is derived from the Middle Persian, which may have its roots into the classic Armenian word kunkut, or the Turkish, on the Turkic kunji. And then there's a related Hindi word gingi, which may echo the rattle of the seeds in the dried capsules. In the eastern reaches of its historical range, the Chinese term huma, or foreign hemp, and jima, or oily hemp, have long been used. The nuttiness of the tiny wafer-like seeds is intensified by toasting, and there are sesame oils for those who enjoy that intensity and those who do not. The oil pressed from the untoasted seeds is pale but fragrant, and is good for baking and for stir-frying and other high-heat cooking because it has a high smoke point. Toasted sesame oil, which is amber, it has a robust flavor, and it's ideal for dressing salads or for adding to already cooked dishes. And definitely don't use it for frying, as it has a very low smoke point. And there is a third oil product from the sesame, as a viscous paste known as amsimsim bitahini in the Arabic-speaking world. And of course, anywhere else is known as tahini. This thick, spreadable paste that we use in many desserts or in sauces, especially in the Lebanese world, which they use it as a sauce. So they whip tahini with lemon juice to coat some fish when frying, and they can make a delicious candy from toasted sesame seeds mixed with caramelized sugar, and so on. Crushed and sweetened sesame seeds are used for making another kind of paste that is dried and hardened into the popular confectionery known as halva, from Eastern Anatolia through Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Palestine, and there's basically similar sweets made with sesame in Egypt throughout North Africa, from Egypt to Morocco and Greece, of course. Now, the third and final spice I want to talk to you about today is the more or less ubiquitous nowadays sumac, or sumaki, as we know it in Greek. And this is really, really popular because it's a spice that's used in the Lebanese cuisine and generally Middle Eastern cuisines a lot. I think it's become popular through Lebanon, Palestine and Syrian cuisine. And generally that's where it's used nowadays a lot. But it has been used in antiquity, in ancient Greece, as a spice, actually, and as a medicine. And it was very popular in the cuisine of the Athenian citizens. And we definitely have references all the way, I think, back from Solon, the ancient Athenian statesman. So what is this lemony, tangy, zingy powder called sumac? It's basically made from the burgundy, red berry-like fruits of the tree called Rus coriaria. And they do offer a very bright and tangy and mouth-puckering punch-up. And flavor profile followed by notes of sweetness and tartness and a bit of saltiness. The sumac fruits from the tree Rus, as we said, they are typically grow in cone-shaped clusters, which deepen in their color as the autumn comes. Each berry has a thin outer skin that surrounds seeds so hard that they often need to be soaked before grinding them into a coarse powder. Sumac, the tree is cultivated more or less in a big area in the West world, westwards from Afghanistan, across the Middle East and the Mediterranean, and as far as the Canary Islands. And the spice, sumac the spice, or simak in the Levant in Arabic, is sold already ground, and basically you dust it on skewered meats immediately before grilling. You generally need a little bit, only a scatter of sumac to get that distinctive color and that lemony zing. In Iran and parts of Turkey, Lebanon and Syria, sumac is among the primary spices used in rubs for all sorts of grilled and baked meats, fish and birds. In some places, through not all, the za'atar spice mixtures that you find, sumac plays a big role in there too. Up to a few years ago, we weren't able to find sumac or nice sumac around the UK's supermarkets. But I think nowadays this is a problem long gone. And that's it. And this is the little episode today about some unknown spices from the Eastern Mediterranean world. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you follow me on Patreon, you'll get a couple of recipes bonus in there, in that podcast, using the aforementioned ingredients. Don't forget to subscribe and support The Delicious Legacy on Patreon. Just search Patreon and The Delicious Legacy Podcast to find out how. And I would like to shout out to all my oldest patrons, Pi R Squared, Alana Salvador, Yana, John Gorner, Kat, Kyle Glover, Michael Zanfardino, Steve Holloway, Leah Potts, Lauren Gaither, Dimitris, Christopher Banks, Dwight Brown, Zane Epti, Phil Ieropoulos, Stereos Hadzikiriakidis, Andrew Cabanis, Guy Joyner, Andrew Kenrick, Tom Eagle, Mark Knight, Damian Bell, and Paul Cooper. And now for the extra bit for Patreon backers only, the recipe for lamb and chickpea stew. These ancient dishes have emerged at different times in multiple places, and it's clearly spread with the Arab and Persian influence as far east as Mongolia. And also, I'm looking forward to the next episode, which is going to be about another precious ancient herb and spice. So stay tuned. My name is Thomas Dinas, and this has been the Delicious Legacy Podcast. Enjoy!
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.